Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
And I've got to say, this week, you being a doctor, not a real doctor, is actually relevant.
Yeah, it is relevant this week because I'm going to bring you some proper physics, hopefully.
Okay, how hopeful are you?
Well, no, I'm sort of quite hopeful, but it's can be seen as quite speculative, I guess is what I want to say.
Okay, is this idle sort of, is this going to be like pub chat?
Not quite. I mean, it's the cutting edge of science, right?
Okay.
So we are answering a question that was put to us on Twitter because we ask our listeners to give us ideas for what they want to know. And if we decide it's interesting, then we'll look at the question. Mm-hmm. So this is from Darren, whose handle is @septchild. Presume that's September. Mm-hmm. Happy birthday. I bet the universe is basically going to make this your birthday, Darren. I bet we're recording this on your birthday because that's how the universe works, isn't it?
Pretty much.
Yeah. So Darren's question is, what's beyond the edge of the universe?
Oh, I like that. And I feel like we've talked about this before, maybe not on the show, but you will tend to come up with some shit like, well, that's like asking what's north of the North Pole. You'll also say, I'm just going to predict some stuff that you'll say. You'll say you don't have any time before time began.
So yeah, we have talked about this before.
There is no before the universe.
But those things are true, right?
Yeah. But I've heard them so often and they're frustrating. They feel like a sort of, they feel like a cheat. They feel like a get out, even if they are true. Are you going to give me a slightly more sensible answer?
It depends what you call sensible, obviously, but I'm going to try.
Thank you. Most of us spend most of our time thinking about ourselves. Instead, why not first think about the world? Then think about the other 100 billion planets in our own galaxy. And then get your head around an estimated 2 trillion galaxies spread across the universe. You should be feeling small now. The vastness of the universe seems incomprehensible to most, with not much knowledge as to what might be out there at its edges or what it's even expanding into. But what about in other universes? What about multiverses? If there are an infinite number of alternative worlds, is there one where, for example, I am a well-respected quantum physicist and Michael Brooks is a radio presenter? Sounds all right. To hopefully put Brooks's mind at rest, this week we're asking, what's beyond the edge of the universe? I'm harbouring a slight fear that you're going to tell me that you have designated yourself today's expert.
It's not implausible, is it?
No, not at all.
I do like to think I have a certain depth of knowledge about some of these things. No, I'm not. I thought about it, but basically we've got somebody who's a bit better at this than me. And
spoilt for choice.
And has actually researched it. So we've got Professor Laura Massini-Houghton, who's a professor of theoretical physics and cosmology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's got a new book out, which I have read.
Congratulations.
It's called Before the Big Bang, The Origin of Our Universe from the Multiverse. And it's actually a really good read.
Did you get paid to read it?
Yeah, I mean, I did review it.
Did you give it a good review?
I did give it a good review. Yeah, yeah. Look, I think it's really interesting. It's kind of provocative. And she's, yeah, I think this kind of area, like, you know, thinking, just asking that question, what's beyond the edge of the universe? And what she's doing, which is sort of relevant to that question, which is looking at whether there's multiverses sort of, you know, outside of our universe, a range of other things. I think that's an amazing thing to be thinking about. And, you know, I've always said, like, we're just primates.
Yeah.
And we have sort of bigger brains than the primates generally, but they're not ridiculous. And we're able to sort of have these thoughts and conversations about, you know, where the entire universe came from. And I just find that amazing.
It is amazing. I still think that we're just going to get into the classic situation where you're very skeptical about what the experts say.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely got doubts. It's healthy to have doubts, right? I think. And these are obviously experts, but I think it's important to say, you know, there's some holes in this argument, or this comes from a place where, you know, you should know certain things about it. So I reserve the right to be skeptical.
Yeah. And I mean, we've been doing cosmology for quite a long time, and we're sort of, I guess we're getting there, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, every ancient culture has sort of done a kind of cosmology.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether it's the Chinese, Indian cultures, Babylonian cultures, they've all had a sense of, like, let's try and put together a model of what the universe looks like, or what we think it is, and how big it is, and what shape it is, and all that kind of stuff. But actually, you know, we are now in this age where we can use astronomical observations. So people talk about us being in a golden age of cosmology at the moment. And it's really only in the last 100 years. And you think, you know, humans have been around, or civilizations have certainly been around for sort of, you know, 4,000 years, 6,000 years, quite complex civilizations with astronomy, you know, with sort of ideas of cosmology. But literally just the last 100 years, we've started to really nail this down now. And so like 1920, astronomers thought that the stars of the Milky Way were like the entire universe. So you look up, you see the Milky Way, you say, that's the full extent of the universe. And then within like a few years of that, so Edwin Hubble worked out that Andromeda was a separate galaxy, and it was sort of, you know, distant. Yeah. And then people started to understand that actually those galaxies were moving away from us. So observations told us that the universe was effectively expanding, and these things were, you know, millions of light years away, expanding away from us. And then people said, oh, if they're expanding away, that must mean they were closer. Mm-hmm. So you sort of extrapolate backwards and you say there must have been a sort of Big Bang event, which, you know, wasn't accepted at first, but is, you know, is now accepted.
We know that they're moving away from our galaxy because of Doppler shift.
Yeah.
So everything's redshifted, isn't it, right?
Yeah, so you can see that it's redshifted, and you can sort of work out how fast they're moving away. Mm-hmm. And of course, initially, everyone thought that, like, well, gravity, the pull of everything on everything else, will be slowing that expansion down. So eventually it'll come to a halt. But actually, in the last few years, we have learned that something is making the expansion speed up. And we have no idea what that is.
It's quite spicy.
It's mad. Mm. I mean, it's so mad that I know some physicists who say that must be wrong.
It can't be true.
Can't be true. Must have got the measurements wrong or made some wrong assumptions somewhere down the line. But you know, we've called this thing dark energy that's sort of accelerating the expansion of the universe. Mm. No idea what it is or where it comes from.
I love
from.
That kind of fudge. It's just like, well, we think that's dark energy.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely like, dark energy.
Okay, and what do we think that is? Well, we don't know. We don't know, but it's making this happen.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There we are.
It's quite cool. I mean, and it's already won a Nobel Prize, which I know a few people were like, no, surely not. But, you know, it seems to be quite a solid observation that the universe's expansion is accelerating.
Hang on, the Nobel Prize was for the observation that the universe is expanding.
No, that it's accelerating.
Dark energy. That it's accelerating. Yeah. But with the dark energy element.
Yeah, yeah.
That is bizarre.
I mean, it was quite fast.
What is it that you're winning a Nobel Prize? Just sort of.
Well, for observations that.
Coming up with quite a good name. Dark energy is name.
Yeah, it's a Nobel Prize for dark energy, isn't it?
Yeah. Nobel Prize for naming something that we don't know what it is.
Yeah, yeah. But so we do know quite a lot about, although, you know, we don't know what there's the dark matter, which is the stuff that fills the universe, mm-hmm. which is most of the universe, which we don't know what it is. So we've been looking for it for like 60 odd years now. But, you know, I'm sure it'll turn up at some point.
Are you?
But we do know from sort of observations that we've got basically some basic facts about the universe and its history. We know that it's 13.8 billion years old.
Yeah.
And it's so unimaginably huge, right? So so the diameter of the observable universe is 92 billion light years.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's big, isn't it?
And we know that, you know, there's probably more than we can see.
What do we mean by observable universe, please?
So the universe expansion is accelerating, which means some of it's moving away faster than the speed of light.
So we'll never see it.
Yeah.
So observable is not the full extent of the universe, basically.
Well, we don't think so. There's no reason why it should be.
No. It'd be a coincidence if we could just see to the edge, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And is there an edge anyway? We'll get to that.
Okay.
So fun fact. So 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the Big Bang, mm-hmm. they think the universe was about 17 centimeters across. It's about the size of your head.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's about a trillionth of a second old, the radius of the universe was the radius of the Earth to the sun. So 93 million miles. So we've gone, you know, woo.
Mm, it's putting on weight.
Yeah, yeah.
Quickly.
When the universe was 1 year old, its temperature was more than 2 million Kelvin. So it's now 2.7 Kelvin. Mm-hmm. So it's got cooler. And then finally, the diameter of the Milky Way is 100,000 light years, right? And that is the radius of the observable universe when it was about 3 years old.
And the Milky Way, our galaxy, is just a pretty bog standard. It's not a big galaxy.
Unremarkable.
Not a small galaxy. Yeah. It's just like just a galaxy.
Yeah, yeah.
Run-of-the-mill stuff.
Yeah. And it's quite cool to know that, isn't it?
It's quite hard to get your head around. It's also quite humbling, isn't it?
I think so.
It does mean that literally nothing matters. That's always my conclusion.
That's one way of looking at it. I mean, I actually think it's all irrelevant
because
I really like this stuff. I actually think, isn't that amazing that we can know that? That like, you know that our galaxy is kind of humdrum, sort of ordinary.
Okay, so you mentioned the Big Bang and the fact that we can kind of figure out that it must have started with something like that.
Yeah.
Have we got any idea what triggered the Big Bang in the first place?
Well, not really what triggered the Big Bang, but we have quite a good picture of what happened after the Big Bang.
Okay.
We've got this thing called the Cosmic Microwave Background Radiation, CMB,
mm-hmm.
and it basically is like a sort of fossil of the universe at the Big Bang. So it's a sea of photons, a sea of radiation that has some of the sort of characteristics of the early universe sort of imprinted onto it. And we're able to read that using our telescope. So you can look at this stuff and say, okay, you know, we can see like this bit is like this and this bit is like that. And that bit's different to that bit, but in a particular way. And so you get this, and it was formed sort of about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. So it's quite close to the beginning, really. Mm-hmm. And we sort of read all of that stuff. And that sort of allows us to make inferences about what the early universe was like. And crucially, you know, what the extent of the universe might be and what might lie beyond it. So I'll let Professor Laura explain.
The main theory that describes what we see in our universe at present goes under the name of cosmic inflation. And the story there is that the universe started as a very small but very smooth patch of space-time full of energies, and that energy made it go through a bank, through an explosion that drove the accelerated expansion, the fast growth of the universe. And as the universe continued expanding, then all the primordial fluctuations in that initial energy, in the energy of inflation, as the universe grows, the temperature drops, the whole universe cools down, and those initial fluctuations will condense under their own weight and create all the structure that we see at present, galaxies, stars, light, any kind of radiation. And in that sense, the leftover radiation from that earliest moment, known as the cosmic microwave background, is our treasure trove for testing all our theories of cosmology of the universe. Now, we know, based on a combination of the theory of Big Bang and these observations of the CMB and the structure, we know that our universe is about 13.8 billion years old, and it has an horizon which is about 10 to the power 27 centimeters. That's 10 with 27 zeros behind it. Those are big numbers, but not outrageously big. We are familiar with numbers like millions and billions and trillions, so it's completely reasonable for us as a human species and as scientists to ask, but what was there before 13.8 billion years ago? How about 14 billion years ago or 15 billion years ago? Can I even ask that question, what was there before the universe came into existence and what lies beyond the horizon of our universe?
I like the questions. And I've already told you what I think your answers are. But let's talk about this idea of whether there is an edge of the universe, first of all.
Yeah.
So how, if there is one, how far away is it?
Right, so first of all, there's no reason to think there would be an edge as such, because it's sort of like, what would be beyond the edge? It's, you know, we live in, it's really hard for our brains to deal with this, right? But the fact is that we know from looking at the CMB that the space-time around us, the universe, the fabric of the universe, is what they call flat, which means that the geometry means that like two parallel light beams will stay parallel however far they travel, and they don't have to, they won't meet, right? So it's sort of like, think of it like a piece of paper, but you can roll up a piece of paper to the point where it's just a tube, and then you're traveling around the circumference of that tube and you'll never find an edge. And it actually, it could be that the universe is like that, or like a donut which doesn't have a boundary. So there's no reason to sort of feel like, you know, that there must be an edge.
Right. But if you think about the universe as a donut, for example, that doesn't mean that there's no such thing as beyond our universe, because you could just have a whole sort of like pack of Krispy Kremes. Yeah, like a load of donuts.
A dozen box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like loads of different universes all next to each other.
Yeah, which sort of gives a sense that there's some like higher dimension effectively, that, you know, so we've got a four-dimensional universe, three dimensions of space, one of time. Mm-hmm. If it's sitting in next to another universe, that implies it's sitting in something else, like outside of space and time, and we don't know what that is, because we've got no way of investigating it. So you can say, yes, you know, maybe what we've got is one isolated donut, and we can't sort of look beyond that. But you're right, I mean, you can imagine that, like, maybe there are other donuts.
Yeah, because I guess if you think about what Professor Laura was saying about this sort of little smooth pocket of space-time with loads of energy in it and then exploding, there's not really any particular reason to imagine that there would only be one of those, is there?
No.
Why would you not have loads of energy balls waiting to explode into a universe?
Yeah, you could do. So that depends on this thing called inflation theory, right? So the idea is that you have this sort of this amount of energy contained within space that just then blows up really fast. Mm-hmm. And sort of alluded to this at the start when we talked about the size of the universe at different sort of moments. And the sort of main accepted theory in physics or in cosmology at the moment is that you had a Big Bang, and then you had this little epoch of inflation where this energy just took over and blew the universe up from being like incredibly small to incredibly big really quickly. Mm-hmm. And the reason people believe that happened is because you have certain things that we observe, like in the cosmic microwave background. Like, for instance, we observe that almost all of the universe is at pretty much the same temperature. And that means that somehow it reached thermal equilibrium with each other. So it's like, you know, you put a cup of coffee in a room and the coffee eventually becomes room temperature because everything equals out. Mm. And if you have like this enormous universe that we've got now, there's no way there's the time available, the 13.8 years, billion years, doesn't give you enough time for that equilibrium to be reached, unless it was all much more compact early on. So you had it all very much more in thermal contact because it was small, and then it suddenly blew up after everything reached the same temperature. So this is called the horizon problem, and it basically allows you to sort of say, okay, if we have that, then we can understand why everything's the same temperature now, and without that, it's quite difficult. And the other thing is the flatness of the universe. So we see that it has this flat geometry from the CMB. And actually that flatness sort of is accounted for by this sort of huge expansion. Like you had a sort of wrinkled up, scrunched up piece of paper that just sort of got flattened out really, really fast. And so people think that there was this era of inflation, but nobody knows where the energy for it comes from. So it's sort of like a bit like you've deferred the problem. It's like, you know, we can solve the flatness problem and the horizon problem by saying we have this incredible sort of sudden expansion. And then some smart aleck at the back of the room says, so what caused that then? And why did it suddenly stop? And the answer is, we don't really know.
It fits with our model.
Yes,
we need that.
Yeah.
Otherwise our model doesn't work.
Yeah. So it's, you know, although it's the accepted sort of thing. So the accepted thing in cosmology is Big Bang plus inflation, right? And that sort of solves most of the problems that we have. We don't know.
Does everyone accept it?
No, not at all. And it's sort of, it is a subject of sort of massive contention amongst the kinds of people who you know, want to ask difficult questions about it. Lots of people just like, well, you know, it sort of works. You know, we've got inflationary models that sort of account for this happening, but they can't account for where the energy comes from. And to be honest, there's like a gazillion different models for inflation that starts at this point, stops at this point. Nobody knows why it stops. You know, maybe there's this thing that stops it.
Literally,
you
know. These are all just ways of trying desperately to fit with the data,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And that's not a good, I mean,
it's not a, good
it's
look,
not
is
a
it?
Great way of doing it. It's kind of, so why have you done that? It seems to work.
It does seem to work. And you get this sort of, you know, so the guy who originally came up with it is a guy called Alan Guth. And, you know, he's had, you know, decades and decades of I think it was like 1997 when he came up with it, or maybe even earlier. And, you know, and it's still, you know, contentious now, sort of, you know, 25 years later, or at least, you know, and people are still saying, I'm not having this. You know, really eminent people saying, you know, no, there must be another way of explaining why the universe is like it is. Because at the moment, you're just pulling this inflation shit out of a hat.
Yeah. It's a sign that I've spent too much time with you that I immediately recognise the name Alan Guth as well. I'm like, yeah, I've definitely
That's
heard this
probably
guy.
Probably because I sat behind him at an awards ceremony once.
Oh, God, it is this. Yeah, yeah, it's an anecdote.
And he it was an awards ceremony for which he was given, I think it was like a check for $1 million for this breakthrough, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
And Morgan Freeman was doing the presentation. And Alan Guth, he obviously maybe just arrived on the plane or over from America because this was in Geneva, and he just fell asleep. I was sat behind him, and he just nodded off.
Do you want your $1 million, Al?
That was funny. And then the autocue broke, and Morgan Freeman refused to carry on. Like, he had the paper notes. He's like, I'm not doing this. I'll wait
I
for the autocue to be
didn't
fixed.
Have the right, he probably didn't have his glasses with him. That is
maybe.
A bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, I very much enjoyed that. And then there was a performance from Sarah Brightman as well. God. A just extraordinary evening.
Yeah, that's a mad evening. I wonder how much Morgan Freeman probably got quite a lot of money for that.
He would have got a lot. I mean, the whole thing was being financed by a Russian billionaire. So,
is this
Yuri Milner?
Breakthrough. Oh, yeah, that guy's got plenty of cash.
Yeah, he was all right.
Come on, Morgan. Okay, I'm going to need to take a quick break, I think, just from my poor little brain. But when we get back, we'll be discussing the multiverse, string theory, and of course, our big question, what is beyond the edge of the universe?
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Okay, let's go back to what we're supposed to be talking about, which is, or what I want to talk about, where might all of this energy that we need to account for inflation have come from?
So this is where Laura started her sort of investigations.
I was interested in that assumption that cosmic inflation makes, which is we start with a small and smooth patch of space full of high energies. So I wanted to find out how strong that assumption is and where did that initial energy come from. The reason for my curiosity there was twofold. First, inflation starts its story at 13.8 billion years ago by putting that energy by hand. So it's not a complete story. It tells us what happened 13 billion years ago to present day, but it doesn't tell us what happened before that. So I was interested in understanding the completed story of inflation, and that meant I was curious on what gave that initial energy that started inflation. But another big factor that drove my curiosity was Sir Roger Spenrose's estimate in the 70s, what is the chance to start a universe small but with lots of energy? And he found that chance of starting a universe with cosmic inflation like we think ours did was practically zero. So that's the most unnatural way of starting a universe. And then that made me curious. I wanted to understand, why did our universe have to start with the most unlikely way a universe can start with? That led me to the theory of a quantum multiverse.
Ooh, quantum multiverse.
Oh, hello.
Brooksy, immediately, boner. So, I've got a question that I don't think you'll be able to answer, so I'm quite pleased with it.
Look at the smugness on that face.
Now, what does it mean to say that something is incredibly unlikely or has zero chance of happening if you don't have time? Because the standard way of thinking about something being very unlikely is you could do this forever and it would never happen.
Yeah.
But without time, what's the...
Yeah. Okay, I mean, it's a good question, obviously.
Yeah,
because
it is.
What you're saying is it's improbable it's going to happen, which means it's a rare event, and rare by definition means that you have time.
You have to have time for it to be rare, and if you don't have time, then it sort of feels meaningless.
Yeah, and I have a huge problem with the whole way that physics sort of deals with this, because they talk about like having a universe that's got high entropy. It's like unlikely to start with high entropy. Surely it should start with low entropy, because high entropy sort of is an unusual state. But entropy itself, the whole definition of it, does involve time and sort of involves assumptions, hidden assumptions about how things happen.
Yeah, you might have to sort of briefly explain entropy. I mean, entropy is sort of disorder.
Yeah, a measure of disorder. And everything moves and towards like...
More disorder.
Starting with a lot of entropy seems unlikely, yeah. Right? Is the whole thing, and you know, she goes into this in her book, and it's sort of the standard way that physicists think about how time began and how the universe began and how our universe had to have a high entropy start. When you sort of think, how does it get to that point? Low entropy start, and you know, which is, you know, unlikely. But essentially, we're dealing with stuff where you're just sort of waving your hands at it and sort of trying to say what might it have looked like, you know, given the assumptions about, you know, the laws of thermodynamics and everything else. And it's really complicated. I think when you start to deal with this and on a daily basis and you're researching it, you start to get a feel for, that doesn't seem right. That, you know, I need to start my mathematical model with something that I don't know how it would have got there in the first place, is what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
So, it's almost, I've never found a good way to describe it and get into it and really sort of find it satisfying to explain.
But it just feels like it's being retrofitted, doesn't it? That's the thing.
Yeah.
You're just desperately trying to crowbar.
Yeah, but you've got to try. You've got to do something.
Yeah, which is fair enough, you know? I suppose.
So
yeah.
What they're doing, and Roger Penrose is he's no slouch. Right,
I'm not slagging off Penrose. Or am I?
I think you might be, and I might join you. But the point is that lots of people have thought about this for a lot of time, and there are sort of certain things that don't seem to work. And what Professor Laura is saying is like she decided that, you know, she wanted to attack this head on and say, you know, actually...
Gotta respect that.
I'm going to look at this problem that we've got of why our universe is so unlikely and see if I can solve it with something that seems to apply, which is, you know, we're talking about something that's incredibly small at the beginning. So maybe you apply quantum laws to it and then, and then maybe you can actually sort of see a way through it.
So how does Laura then make this leap to deciding that we live in a quantum multiverse, or is that the leap that she's made?
All right, so let me start by sort of defining what this multiverse is, because people have heard of lots of different kinds of multiverse.
Yes.
So there's the, I didn't really realize this, but people have been talking about multiverses since Babylonian and Greek times, there being lots of different universes and ours just being one of them. And in sort of the Middle Ages, there was a scholar called Robert Grosseteste who sort of came up with an argument saying, you know, there could be lots of different universes and ours is just one of those. And the Pope sort of said, no, we're not having that. Banned all his writings.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So basically, you know, we've sort of been thinking in those terms, but the one that gets talked about the most these days is the quantum sort of many worlds multiverse, where you have quantum physics, which says that things exist or seem to exist in these multiple states at once, or do multiple different things at once. And the way that we sort of solve that in terms of understanding how our universe comes to be is we say, oh, there's one universe where the electron goes left, and there's one universe where the electron goes right. And therefore, you've got two different universes. And this happens with every single quantum event.
Yeah, so then you're just branching and branching and branching and branching and branching until you've effectively got an infinite number.
Near infinite number of worlds with, you know, and some people will say with, you know, near infinite number of copies of us sort of in those worlds.
Yes.
Really sort of strange way of thinking. But, you know, like David Deutsch, who, by the way, has just won his own $1 million breakthrough prize.
Did he fall asleep?
He hasn't been to the ceremony yet. It's literally just been announced, I think, today.
Let's wait and see. What did he win it for?
For coming up with, I think, multiverse ideas, actually.
is this money for old rope? So we need to get on this.
Yuri.
Listen, Yuri. No, I've not got a lot of mass to back it up.
But David Deutsch firmly believes in the quantum multiverse, in this idea of these myriad different worlds. And he thinks there's more evidence or more reason to believe that than there is to believe that the dinosaurs existed. So he's sort of on record as basically saying, this definitely is how it is.
There's definitely not more evidence. He can't be saying that.
He kind of is.
He cannot. Well, there's literally zero evidence.
Yeah.
He's got zero evidence. Yeah.
Except in the maths, he says.
That's not the same.
Yeah, anyway. So that's one sort of type of multiverse. And then you've got this cosmological multiverse. And we sort of alluded to this earlier. So you said, like, if you've got all this inflation, maybe it's all going on all the time. Mm. And so you've got this energy, which is sort of blowing up space-time. And so the idea is that you get a multiverse from the fact that, you know, in our universe, there's a little region of space-time that's got a little bit of energy and it's just blowing up and budding off into another new universe. Mm. And so you get all these different universes form just from this cosmic inflation energy.
Yeah.
If it exists.
Yeah.
And so then you get a multiverse from that. There's also, I mean, Roger Penrose has this idea that you can get the seeds of new universes out of sort of the remnants of black holes, effectively, or some kind of event where you get a collapse of our universe and then, you know, a new universe.
The big crunch.
The big crunch, and it explodes into a new Big Bang. Mm. And so you've effectively got this sort of succession of universes. Mm. That's a sort of slightly different idea. But he thinks
that's sort of gone out of fashion, the Big Crunch idea, isn't it?
Well, no, it's still around. Sort of still around. Yeah. And Penrose is now saying that he thinks he's seen evidence of these other universes in the cosmic microwave background radiation. So he's put out papers in the last couple of years that suggest that you know, there are certain sort of scars visible in the fabric of our universe through the cosmic microwave background, and you can see this. So he's still on it.
I'll tell you the big news for me there is, I thought he was dead.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know why I thought that.
He's just turned 91. I interviewed him.
Of course you did.
About a month ago. I did an interview with him at Oxford, and he was alive then. I mean, I hope I didn't kill him.
And still working. Wow.
Yeah, still working. Fair play. It's not bad, is it?
Is there a sort of just a really simple version of the multiverse where it's just that effectively the multiverse is contained within one universe. Our universe is effectively infinite in size, and therefore you're just going to find repeats of everything.
Yeah, so you get the same arrangement of atoms somewhere else because that's going to happen.
It's just mathematically, if you're sort of in an infinite space, then you would.
So you effectively get a copy of you if you're far enough away.
Yeah.
Because you'll get every sort of formation repeating itself.
But also there'd be an infinite number of other you. I mean, it's a head fucker.
Yeah, it is.
But you know what I mean? Just like a sort of brute size.
Yeah.
Sort of argument for multiverse is quite interesting.
Yeah. So it's a different kind of multiverse, isn't it? Because it's the contents that are sort of replicating in some ways.
Yes, within one universe, I guess. Yeah.
And then the other kind of multiverse, and this is relevant to what we're going to talk about, it's called the string landscape universe, where when you're doing string theory, which is a kind of, you know, theory of that ties together quantum and gravity, then you get different sort of mathematical solutions to your equations. And they're basically saying they get solutions that correspond to lots of different universes, and there might be as many as 10^500 of those universes, of those different solutions.
Right.
And maybe they all exist. Mm. And maybe they're all out there because, you know, the math says that they're all possible. So maybe they're there.
Is string theory the one where you have to sort of assume that there's a load of dimensions that we can't see? They're all sort of balled up somewhere.
Yeah, balled up, compactified, they call it.
Yeah, well, I'm going with balled up, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so the idea is that you have sort of 7 or 8 dimensions that we can't see or interact with.
It's convenient.
But that's what makes the maths work.
Yeah.
And maybe there are.
Stop fudging your maths, guys.
Yeah. And so the idea is that everything sort of comes from these strings, which are sort of vibrating bits of energy, and they vibrate in one way and it's a photon and another way and it's an electron. And, you know, you put this all together and you can create a kind of, you know, a model of our universe, effectively. Mm. And Laura's multiverse fits in with this kind of string landscape idea.
Since our universe is very small at the beginning, we know that experimentally our universe has been expanding, so it must have started very small to reach the size it has today. Since our universe was very small, then it must have been a quantum object. Now, in quantum mechanics, one can think of a particle as a wave packet instead of a particle. It's something that is known as wave-particle duality. So I thought, okay, I will think of the universe that at its earliest moments, rather than an object, I'll think of it as a wave. And that goes under the name a wave function of the universe. I was lucky because when I was interested in studying this question of the early universe and what was there before the Big Bang, string theory, that is the leading theory, the leading candidate for that underlying theory of nature of quantum gravity, string theory had ended up predicting a whole field of energies, a whole landscape of possible energies to start the universe from.
Well, I'm not going to lie, I think I'm getting a bit lost now.
Putting it as simply as I can.
Yes, please.
She basically says, okay, so the universe starts out very small.
Yeah.
It's a quantum object. A quantum object, you can't define it as being a wave or a particle.
It's
sort of something in between.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have in her sort of scheme of it is a load of overlapping quantum waves,
mm-hmm.
which are all the possibilities, all the possible energies of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so she says, basically, you know, these create or they seed different loads and loads of different universes, which are all, because they're sort of these overlapping waves, they entangle together. So she invokes quantum entanglement where, you know, you can't define this quantum object as separate from that one.
Yeah.
Actually, they sort of affect each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we know this is real. We know this happens. We do experiments that prove this sort of weird action that Einstein sort of referred
spooky
to.
Spooky action at a distance.
And what she has done is come up with a scheme using sort of standard quantum mechanics where you take all of these different energies that you find in string theory and you create lots of different universes with them, all with different energies. And they effectively then separate off from each other, but the entanglement between them sort of leaves a scar on the sort of skin of the universe, on the fabric of the universe.
Mm.
And then you can see what kind of properties that scar would have. And if that scar is real, then you would see it or some evidence of it on the cosmic microwave background radiation.
And do we?
Yes.
Ah.
Yes. And okay. This is where my mind sort of got blown, right? Is that she made, with her collaborators, she sort of did all these calculations, worked out what this, you know, these separating universes, which all become isolated universes in a multiverse.
But sort of entangled.
They're sort of like entangled donuts.
Yeah.
And
it's a nice image.
Yeah. And then she said, you know, but what would the imprint of one be on the other? Like with donuts, you know, when they bake next to each other, you pull them apart and you get a little scar on the outside.
Yeah,
it's the same kind of thing, right? And she says, you know, this scar will be evidence on the cosmic microwave background. And she made seven predictions of like what these scars would look like.
Yeah.
The first one was that it would be what's called a giant void, where there's a sort of gap in the CMB. It doesn't sort of...
Oh, and there is, isn't there?
And there is a giant void.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Right. And I think out of the seven, she now has sort of tentative, suggestive evidence for six of the things that they predicted. They sort of see those as features of the cosmic microwave background. Now, that doesn't mean they're caused by other multiverses. It just means there are these features which can be explained if you invoke these other universes called leaving scars on each other.
Okay,
so you have to be quite careful about, you know, how you phrase
it. Yeah. What do other people, what do other cosmologists think about what she's saying? Do they buy it?
There are people who find it interesting. And they're like, you know, so a lot of the time with stuff like this, what physicists do is say, oh, okay, can't necessarily sort of argue against it. It seems quite interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, let's wait and see what else sort of comes out of it. Other people come out all guns blazing and say, no, that's not true. You've made a false assumption here. And there are people who say, you know, that isn't right. What she's claiming basically doesn't have any sort of, you know, she sort of misinterpreted the way entanglement works out, or you know, the way a universe one would decouple from the other kind of thing. And so there are people who are saying, no, that's not true. That can't be right. There are other people who are saying, well, it's interesting. I'm willing to sort of, you know, keep an open mind about it. And, you know, Professor Laura herself says, well, you know, we made six predictions or seven predictions, and six of them seem to have been borne out. So we're quite confident that we're on the right track.
What's happening with the seventh one? Do we know?
So that is to do with something called the dark flow, which is a kind of movement of stuff through the universe, which we kind of see some evidence of, but some people are saying it sort of come from some kind of telescope bias or some inherent bias in the instruments. So the jury's out on whether that's real, but right, there's certainly evidence for it, you know, if you want to believe it. So, so I'm sort of sitting on the fence and sort of saying, well, you know, I don't know. Lots of people come out with outlandish things. You know, nobody rips into David Deutsch for his just, you know, believing in the multiverse more than the dinosaurs kind of thing.
Well, I do, but yeah.
But nobody, people respect his right to kind of have that opinion in physics, if you like.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have to respect, you know, this as a sort of a valid way of exploring the beginning of the universe. And who knew we could like go back and look at what might be beyond the edge of our universe and all this stuff. You know, so you have to sort of give some latitude, I think, to extrapolate. Even if it turns out to be wrong, even if it turns out to be, you know, fundamentally flawed, it's an interesting thing to look into. And nobody else has any answers.
And I suppose the fact is that we are never going to be able to directly observe outside of our universe. So you're only ever going to be looking for sort of indirect evidence like this, aren't you?
Yeah.
We're never going to be able to travel beyond our universe, sort of by definition.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of my problems with it is like it's based on string theory, right? Which doesn't have any experimental support. And I think string theory just seems like a bit of a grab in the dark in terms of, you know, we just don't know. Like you say, you have to sort of account for the compactification of these dimensions. You know, we've got no way of testing it. Like because it operates at such high energies, if we wanted a Large Hadron Collider, but for string theory, you know, to sort of do some experimental tests, it would have to be the size of a galaxy, basically,
right,
to get to the energies that we require. Obviously, that's not going to happen. And so we're in a position where we're just sort
good
of looking
for the string theorists. Though, yeah. They're like, well, we would make it, but it's the budget.
So you know, it depends what you want to say. And the fact is, string theory is our best option at the moment for unifying so far, quantum with gravity. But that doesn't mean it's right. It's just, you know, this is a long-term quest, really. And if it turns out to be wrong, then Laura's kind of building her model on something that's effectively wrong. But it doesn't mean that, you know, it's not worth doing, if you see what I mean. So I'm backing her.
Yeah.
But I'm not putting all my money on her.
I tell you what, it is a big old leap. That first leap, which is the universe at the point of the Big Bang is obviously very, very small. So we're just going to say it's a quantum particle and then model it from there, and you're like,
and then you model it using inflation, saying, oh, it just blows up. Don't know really why or how,
and now it's got huge.
Yeah. And then we need a bit of string theory.
Yeah, like it's a bit of a grab bag of stuff.
It is a little
bit. This maybe works at this point, and then you wave your hands a bit, and then it gets big, and then we take this from here, and then that might work. And it's sort of, I don't know,
the phrase pinch of salt comes to mind.
Yeah.
But no, you know, nobody's sort of, you know, living or dying based on this. It's just interesting.
It's effectively, it's just a bit of fun. Like, genuinely, it's just like, well, what do we think? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Make no difference to anyone.
No, but it does sort of give us at least some kind of way of saying, I wonder if we can answer the question, what lies beyond the edge of the universe?
Yeah. What did Laura say about this, by the way?
Well, let's hear.
Beyond the edge of our universe, beyond the horizon, there lies a very beautiful, fascinating and intricate structure of the cosmos, where our universe, in that vast picture of many universes and many, many structures, our universe occupies just a very humble corner in that vast cosmos. And I don't find that disturbing or surprising at all, because the way I look at that, that view is a extension of the Copernican paradigm. We not long ago we thought our Earth is the center of the universe and our solar system, and then we moved to the galaxy, and then we moved to our universe being the it, the cosmos. And now we are discovering that our universe is not at the center of the cosmos, it's just one of many, many other structures and many other universes, and the whole ensemble makes understanding nature more intriguing and more beautiful.
Absolutely love the confidence of saying, and now we're discovering that. Well, we're not, are we? You're speculating wildly. But I take her point. It's just like we just get increasingly less and less relevant.
But there is some data, at least. You know, we're basing it on, you know, we're not just making stuff up like, you know, the Greeks would make stuff up or the Babylonians would make stuff up. We're saying, what does it mean that we see this light coming into our telescopes? You know, what does it, how can we interpret that kind of thing? So I think it's kind of, you know, it is interesting, and it just blows my mind that we're able to do something like this. And maybe we're wrong. Maybe all our conclusions are wrong, but it's still worth doing.
Yeah. No, I agree. But what's your best bet on? So 500 years from now, people look back on this and talk about it in the same way and just go, well, obviously they're just making stuff up. Like we're saying that about the Greeks and the Babylonians just making stuff up. I think they'll say that about us.
I think they might, yeah.
It's quite likely.
But have they got something better? That's what I'd like to ask them.
That's the interesting thing. You like to imagine, science always likes to imagine, that you're progressing and you're refining everything. You're sort of getting better and better and getting more and more knowledge. I don't know if that's always necessarily true.
No, I don't think so. No, I'm not sure that we're sort of much better off in terms of this kind of stuff than we ever were. But we do have some, you know, technological tools that help us answer help us come up with answers. We don't necessarily, they're not the right answers, but they're sort of, you know, good ideas.
Also, I mean, let's not overlook the fact we're getting some absolutely lovely pictures out of the James Webb.
Exactly.
It's really nice.
They are nice. Did you see that one of Neptune?
Yeah, sick.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Professor Laura Massini-Houghton. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also really love hearing from you guys. So if you have any burning questions you want us to answer, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london, or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.